Welcome to Deep North. My name is Eric Pomerenke, and I am joined today in the studio by Iceland Review contributing writer Frank Walter Sands. Today, we are going to be taking a look at his piece, Skeletons in the Closet, Icelandic Nazis and Their Quiet Homecoming.
Saturday, May 18th, 1946, was a pleasant spring morning in Denmark's capital, Copenhagen. The war, with all its horror, had ended a year previously, and Western Europe was gradually moving towards a civil society based on human rights, justice, and democracy, while simultaneously rebuilding and ridding itself of the last vestiges of Nazi occupation. At Vestre Fangelsa prison, a 36-year-old Icelandic detainee sat alone in his cell, reading an English novel his younger brother had brought for him. When he had been taken into custody, he had been certain that the arrest order was built on an unfortunate misunderstanding and that he would surely be released once the post-war situation had calmed. A long, boring, and lonely year later, he was still awaiting trial, having been indicted on a number of onerous charges. His hope was flagging, and none of this boded well for his future. The large brick prison had been built in the previous century and housed some 500 detainees, many on suspicion of outright treason or of collaborating in some way with the Nazis during Denmark's 5 years of occupation under German forces. The Icelandic prisoner's cell, containing a narrow, steel-framed bed and a small wooden desk, was cramped but tidy, with little more than a few books to keep him company. The thick, white-painted walls echoed with his fellow inmates' murmurs and muffled whispers. A skilled musician, the Icelander would at times be allowed to play his violin to lighten the mood of his fellow inmates, his alternatively joyous and mournful melodies reverberating on the heavy brick walls throughout the prison block. His mother, whom he dearly loved, had come all the way from Iceland to visit him not long after his arrest. She was given precisely 10 minutes to see her son. Due to the prison regulations, they were forced to keep the conversation light, speaking about his health and family, but avoiding any mention of his incarceration or what had landed him in these desperate straits. He had last seen his father and mother in April 1940, just after the German invasion of Denmark. His father, Svein Björnsson, had been serving as an official Icelandic representative in Copenhagen and had departed for Iceland with the rest of the family at the first opportunity. Despite the fascist occupation, Björn had, to his parents' consternation, decided to remain in Europe, perceiving the Nazis as a force for good in the fight against communism. Since that fateful day, much more had transpired than he dared recount. He had been relieved to learn that his young daughter, Brynhildr, would be brought back home to Iceland and given a good upbringing by his parents, from whom he had been more or less estranged for some years. His mother neglected to tell him that she had already gone through all of his daughter's belongings and destroyed letters and anything else that could any way be connected to his past, including a beloved portrait of her father in military uniform that Brynhildr had kept by her bedside. The Icelander had initially been told by his lawyer that little could be done in his legal defense. Reluctantly, he had long since resigned himself to the possibility of his trial ending with a conviction that would result in long years in a Danish prison. In the mid-morning, a prison guard arrived, his keys jangling, but otherwise maintaining strict silence. With a metallic click and a creak of the iron door, his cell was open. The Icelander closed his book and rose to stand at attention, anticipating yet another inspection by prison guards. Instead, he was baffled to see his lawyer, a fellow Icelander, standing just outside the cell doorway with a hint of a smile on his face. The guard gruffly instructed him, with considerably less charm than his lawyer, to get his personal items packed and ready for transport. Perhaps his request to be transferred to a British prison had finally been approved, which he had hoped would be safer and a bit more comfortable than the Danish jail. The lawyer then made a most unexpected announcement in Icelandic. Þú ert frjáls. You are free. His detainee status, the lawyer went on, was officially rescinded, and he was to be released forthwith. Ha! What do you mean? Replied the detainee. The lawyer, who was also a cousin of his, elaborated. All charges against him, including treason against the Danish state, a capital offense, had been dropped due to his Icelandic citizenship and permanent residence in Germany. He was to be expelled from Denmark, never to return. Hardly believing his good fortune, the gaunt Icelander with a high forehead, thinning hair, and bright blue eyes would get to go home to Iceland after nearly 15 years in Europe. Björn Sveinsson Björnsson, a decorated officer of the Waffen-SS, the elite paramilitary wing of the Nazi Party, who had enthusiastically taken an oath of allegiance to Adolf Hitler, was once again a free man. During the German occupation of Denmark, some 17,800 Danes were forced to flee to Sweden. Among these refugees was the majority of Denmark's population of some 7,000 Jews who were smuggled to safety by the resistance. Over the course of German occupation, some 6,000 Danes were sent to concentration camps, among which were 500 Danish Jews. At least 500 Danes were killed in German concentration camps during the war. A year after the war's end, the mood in Denmark remained grim. The pain and suffering that occupation had brought was like a nightmare from which the Danes were still waking. Reprisals and executions against those who had chosen to collaborate with the Nazis was commonplace across most of Europe. A Danish friend of Björn's and a fellow volunteer, Fleming Helvig Larsen, who had fought alongside him with the Waffen-SS on the Eastern Front and had worked closely with him as a Nazi propagandist in Denmark, had been arrested just 5 months before. Helvig Larsen, 2 years younger than Björn, had been accused of war crimes, including murdering a Danish partisan. After a brief trial, he was convicted and duly executed by firing squad. Apart from those gunned down in the streets or hanged by the neck from lampposts by resistance forces, 46 convicted collaborators had already been executed by the Danish courts in recent months, while an additional 32 were sentenced to life in jail. During the war, Björn's high profile as a Nazi SS officer in charge of radio and newspaper propaganda in occupied Denmark had made him a high-value target for resistance forces. Vigilance and security was vital to his survival. On official business, he was usually accompanied by several armed soldiers, in addition to the 9mm Luger pistol and an M39 fragmentation grenade that he was in the habit of carrying. In addition to faithfully sending out a steady stream of Nazi propaganda meant to bolster the occupying forces, he had been responsible for recruiting young Danish men to the Nazi SS forces through newspaper and radio. Björn had also been in charge of Nazi propaganda transmissions that were regularly sent to Iceland during the war in an attempt to discredit and otherwise undermine the Allies via shortwave radio. His superiors in the Waffen-SS were impressed with his dedication and skills.
Lieutenant Björnsson has an impeccable personality and solid ideals. He has a disciplined temperament and a good mental capacity, a hard-working and energetic soldier, disciplined and refined in demeanor. His willingness to fight is exemplary. As the commander of the Copenhagen Division of the regiment, Lieutenant Björnsson has done an outstanding job in recruiting the Waffen-SS units and increasing influence in the Danish media. He has also proved successful in combat as a soldier during the invasion of the Soviet Union.
On the day of Danish liberation, May 5th, 1945, the consul from the Icelandic embassy had called Björn to warn him that his life was in grave danger. Fellow Icelander and noted author, playwright, and director Guðmundur Kampan, suspected by many of working for the Nazis in Copenhagen, had just been shot and killed by the resistance militia unit, apparently while refusing to comply with a warrant for his arrest. Björn's name, he had been well aware, was on the resistance's blacklist, who knew he was the main man behind Nazi propaganda in Denmark. It was entirely likely that the resistance would attempt to assassinate Björn now that he was a free man, given his long service to the Nazis. The Icelandic consul urged Björn to seek sanctuary behind the embassy walls, where he could stay as long as he needed. Björn realized that with the Germans defeated and the war in Europe over, he would be obliged to inform local authorities that he was prepared to surrender peacefully. Just 2 days after liberation, on May 7, 1945, Björn exchanged his Nazi SS uniform for a civilian suit and tie and left his pistol and grenade at the embassy. He had naively agreed to meet the Danish police authorities for a, quote, debriefing, unquote, which began with him being locked in an armed van, supposedly for his protection, and ended with his indefinite detainment behind bars. Following his release after a year of incarceration, getting out of Copenhagen as quickly as possible was Björn's first priority. Since Denmark had been liberated, there was little doubt that the Danish resistance movement, which had continued to exact extrajudicial vengeance upon collaborators and local Nazis, would demand a reckoning if they could get to him. With the help of the Icelandic embassy and a new passport, Björn managed to evade justice by boarding the Öresund ferry in Copenhagen that brought him to relative safety in nearby Sweden. 3 weeks after his release from prison, Björn disembarked from the Icelandic merchant ship Lagerfoss in Reykjavik Harbor. He was happiest to recognize the faces of his mother and one of his daughters in the crowd. The former Nazi officer was greeted warmly by family and friends, who held a celebration party in his honor. Tears were in the eyes of many. As he would later recount in his autobiography, few words were spoken, because at that moment, words were unnecessary. His father and mother, Svet and Georgia Björnsson, welcomed him heartily and insisted that Björn stay with them as long as he needed. However, Björn's parents had one very strict rule that he must unswervingly obey and unconditionally accept. He was never to talk of his experiences as a Nazi soldier, officially or otherwise. Not to the press, not to his friends or acquaintances, and especially not to his family. I was ready to come clean and tell the entire story so that the people would not assume the worst, but it was not to be. While serving the Nazis, Björn had worked in the SS War Correspondent Division, was sent to the Eastern Front, and had fought in several battles during Hitler's war with the Soviet Union. In doing so, he fought in one of the bloodiest and most brutal wars in human history. In his own words, Björn explained his attraction to the Nazi cause. I was volunteering for military service with the Waffen-SS because I wanted to fight. That was the purpose. I wanted to fight against communism. Although he claimed to bear no prejudice towards Jews, he freely admitted that he was influenced by Nazi propaganda. Although I found the treatment of the Jews inhumane, I nevertheless often overlooked this. According to Nazi newspapers, the Jews were to blame for all the world's inequality and corruption. I, myself, contracted something from this propaganda, just as so many others had. For any family in the tightly knit society of Iceland, reintegrating a wayward son who had brought such humiliation and shame would be tremendously fraught. But for the Björnsson family, the stakes were substantially higher. For this reason, Björn's influential father had personally requested that all Icelandic newspapers avoid recounting his son's Nazi past, which was almost universally heeded. Given his family's considerable capital, both political and financial, it is understandable that the Icelandic media of the time yielded to the unusual request. Björn's father, Sveinbjörnsson, had been elected as the colonial governor of Iceland during Denmark's occupation in the war. After Iceland claimed independence in 1944, he became the first president of the newly founded republic. Björn understood that his presence in post-war Iceland remained profoundly controversial and awkward for his family, not least for his father, Sveit. On return to Iceland, I realized I must have caused my father immeasurable worries and put him in an especially difficult position with regard to my actions. In the wake of Germany's defeat by the Allies in the Second World War, virtually everything German was considered malevolent, sinister, or at the very least, suspicious. Revelations of the extent of Nazi crimes against humanity, not least of which was the Holocaust, were revealed to the world at the Nuremberg trials in 1945-46. Despite the press blackout in Iceland, Björn's military service with the Waffen-SS was an ill-kept secret, an insidious scandal that continued to cause his entire family chagrin. Björn's younger brother, a dentist in Reykjavik, was frequently asked by his patients whether he was indeed related to the infamous Icelandic Nazi. It was clear to Björn that his family would be better off without him serving as a perpetual reminder of his Nazi past and connections. When he proposed moving back to Europe, perhaps to the bombed-out remains of his beloved Hamburg, his parents were outraged and flatly refused to condone the idea. He was to have no further connection to any former comrades, German friends, or Germany in general. Thus, when he and his newly married second wife announced that they were selling their house in Kopavogur and moving with their daughter Brynhildr to South America for a fresh start, no argument or protest was heard from the Björnsson family. Björn later returned to Iceland in the 1960s and found work teaching music and languages at various Icelandic schools. With his command of Danish, German, English, and Spanish, combined with his deep knowledge of his native land, Björn was also a popular tourist guide for many years. The world had, for the most part, moved on from seeking out former Nazis and bringing them to justice. After a reawakening of interest in his case in the 1980s, he decided it was time to tell his story. Björn published his provocatively titled memoir, The Story That Could Not Be Told, in 1989, in which he attempted to address his past actions, albeit with some obfuscation. Björn lived out the end of his long life in Borgarnes, West Iceland, breathing his last at the age of 88 in the company of his family. His obituary in Iceland's center-right newspaper Morgunblaðið, co-founded by Björn's uncle, avoided mentioning his role as a Nazi SS officer, ending with, quote, "His path in life was long and arduous, but now he has come home and rests in Icelandic soil," unquote. In the intervening years, historians and journalists have raised the question as to why the few Icelanders who actively worked with the Nazis managed to evade any trial or convictions for war crimes. Ólafur Pétursson, a young Icelandic accountant living in Quisling's fascist Norway during the early part of the war, volunteered to spy on the Norwegian anti-fascist partisans for the Nazi Abwehr, the German Army's intelligence service. After going undercover as an Icelander dedicated to Norwegian resistance, Ólafur was able to provide his Abwehr superiors with scores of names of resistance partisans. In June 1942, a series of arrests rounded up Norwegian partisans and others that opposed the Nazis and the fascist Quisling government of Norway. In total, 45 Norwegian men and women were arrested and interrogated by the authorities. While 18 were eventually released, the other 27 were sent to Nazi concentration camps, where they spent up to 3 years. 9 of these prisoners were killed, most through execution. With his cover potentially blown, Oliver moved to Denmark for the remainder of the war. Not long after Danish liberation, Oliver boarded the Icelandic passenger ship Esjan, bound for Reykjavik. Before they could leave Copenhagen Harbor, a British naval ship blocked their passage, searched the ship, and arrested Oliver. After many months as a detainee, he was interrogated at length and brought to trial. The prosecution sought the death sentence for the, quote, Icelandic executioner, unquote, but the judge ruled that Oliver would be sentenced to 20 years hard labor. Nevertheless, Iceland's government demanded his release. In order to avoid a diplomatic incident, the Norwegian authorities consented to set Oliver free. He returned to Iceland, where he founded a successful accounting firm, fathered 3 children, and lived comfortably with his family. One left-leaning newspaper, Þjóðviljan, The Will of the Nation, published a series of articles describing Oliver's role in the death of Norwegian resistance partisans. Outraged, Oliver sued the newspaper and its editor for libel, in a case lasting several years. In the end, however, he lost and was ordered to pay the defendant's legal fees. In granting former Nazis sanctuary after the Second World War, Iceland was hardly unique among Western nations. Even as the war still raged in Europe, many Western leaders already looked to the Soviet Union as the next great geopolitical rival. Indeed, throughout the Cold War, in efforts to fight communism, Western governments deliberately chose to work with known disgraced Nazis. For example, under the aegis of Project Paperclip and Operation Sunrise, the United States helped Nazis flee through the so-called rat lines. Many ended up in South America and the United States, where they were offered protection and a new life. In a short span of time, the former enemies had made amends in the name of anti-communism, with the Nazis ending up everywhere from NASA to the CIA. Similar examples of ideological flexibility can be found in nations as diverse as Argentina, West Germany, and Egypt. While some of these dynamics were at play in Iceland, it also occupied a singular position among the post-war Western democracies. As a small, newly independent nation, Iceland had a strong desire to start with a clean slate. Perhaps authorities believed that legal wrangling over Icelanders with a Nazi past would only serve to confuse and upset people. When trying to understand why certain Icelandic Nazis did not see justice, one cannot help but notice their status and the connections within society and government. What were the exact motivations, political, societal, or otherwise, that led the Icelandic authorities to help Björnsveit Björnsson, Oliver Pettersson, and others who had actively participated in one of the most murderous and barbaric regimes in history evade any punishment for their actions? If Icelandic authorities hope to avoid complacency with war crimes in the future, it's a question that must be answered.
Well, thank you for sharing the article today, Frank.
Thank you, Eric. It was very interesting for me to learn about this subject, and I hope that the listeners and readers will enjoy it as much as I have.
So as I recall, last fall, around October, November 2023, there was some new information that came out about the noted Icelandic playwright Guðmundur Kampan. And he is mentioned briefly in this story. And, you know, in some sense, this piece kind of grew out of that story. So, you know, maybe you could just really quickly give us a quick breakdown as to Guðmundur Kampan. Who was he? And like, what was this new information that was released?
Yeah, and a fascinating figure, no question about it. In terms of the way this article developed, which is a very interesting point, Originally, the news itself of the releasing of his murderer's name became the focus of my article until I realized that the other character, his contemporary Bjørnsveinn Bjørnson, was actually a lot more compelling. But Gudmundur himself was a very interesting character. He was clearly misunderstood. Born in the late 1880s as a farmer's son, he quickly showed his high intelligence and incredible memory, as well as his ability to write plays. At the same time, he was known for being a mystical person who could speak with spirits and could perform automatic writing on dead authors and so forth, until, unfortunately, he contracted an illness in his late teens and suddenly was struck with a lack of ability to perform, so to speak. And after that, became a noted playwright living in Denmark, Switzerland, England, America for a time, and for a very long time, Germany. He became a darling of the intellectual Germans in the pre-war era. And as the war started, he left and lived more in Denmark. Now, the problem was, because he was so popular in Germany and had done several speaking engagements there, it was always unclear where his loyalties lay. And it has now been revealed that he most certainly was not an active Nazi, but he certainly did collaborate with them, at least in terms of his production and his entertainment.
Mm. Yeah, you know, I think that one of the interesting tensions in this piece, maybe not tension, but just one of the things that I was thinking about, you know, we have this beginning scene with Bjørn Sveinsson waiting in jail. And, you know, we are in the immediate aftermath of one of the most violent and ideological conflicts in human history. And yet there's something kind of funny and absurd about kind of awaiting, you know, a verdict on your trial and being represented by a lawyer in the immediate aftermath of this, you know, just truly horrible conflict. And, you know, I mean, I suppose I don't really have a point here, maybe, but it's just kind of interesting to think about how, you know, fragile these institutions like law and justice and democracy are, and, you know, just who sees justice after a conflict like this, you know, like how important it is to like reestablish these institutions after this massive rupture in European history.
I think this is a very interesting point to discuss. One of the things that became clear to me when reading the autobiography of Björn and then also reading other accounts of his life was that he had a hard time understanding why anybody could give him or could think of him as guilty of anything like a war crime. The way he saw it, and I'm not saying I agree with him, he said, look, I was fighting communism. I didn't have anything against Jewish people. I was just fighting in a war against the Stalinistic Soviets, and I was doing my best to, you know, bring soldiers and so forth for that cause. So whether or not he actually believed that, that is what he in fact said. And you have to imagine, after the war, there were literally millions of people who had been either collaborators or soldiers or even, you know, the actual top Nazis. Is the idea to like completely wipe them out? I wasn't aware until more recently how many hundreds of thousands of Nazis lived in West Germany after the war and were able to live very decent lives. But as mentioned in the article, a lot of the worst or the most notorious had to leave and live in other countries. But the point is that everybody in Germany of a certain age has stories of an uncle or a grandfather who took part. And these stories are mostly obscured because they're not things that people were terribly proud of, at least generations later.
Mm. It certainly drew my attention, this one quote from Sveinbjörn Sveinsson, where, you know, he says something to the effect of, "I contracted something from this propaganda." And, you know, there is a curious way in which, you know, in order to escape being held accountable for his actions, you know, it seems to be very common move to kind of give up one's agency, which, you know, it's obviously a very different thing to be a teenager growing up in the 20s in Germany and to be going through the economic and historical turmoil of that time period and to be kind of caught up in a certain movement. It is clearly another thing to live abroad, to live in Iceland, and to choose to join the Waffen-SS. And, you know, I mean, obviously, I think that's very unsatisfactory to just say that he was kind of caught up in propaganda, because, you know, to choose to make the journey across the Atlantic Ocean in order to join a crack paramilitary wing of the fascist party, you know, that is clearly something that requires agency. Like, that is an active choice that he made. And, you know, I mean, it did strike me as very interesting, like the ways in which he tried to excuse his choices.
I think that's a very interesting point as well, because if we think about it in a modern sense, for any listener, we all have, well, most of us are people who try to vote or take part in the politics of our time. And if we look in certain places such as the United States, there's no question that although the two main contenders for the presidential race have certain qualities that make them attractive to people, that there are many qualities, or let's say characteristics, of both of these people which a lot of people abhor. And nevertheless, they remain popular politicians. And I think it's very much the same thing with Björnsson. He probably said, look, in general, I don't necessarily love the Nazis, but I certainly don't like those communists. And if I have to have a choice in the matter, I will support the Nazis. And I think it came down to something that, combined with, ooh, think of all the adventure of putting on a military uniform and holding a gun and hearing the rat-a-tat-tat at the battlefield, and I'll come home and women will admire me. I think there was a lot of that naivete playing a part in this. And I think it's important for us in our modern context to try to apply similar kind of, contrary forces that were on every person living at that time, and understanding that people were making choices that they did not necessarily understand the repercussions or the consequences. And I believe that many of these younger men were very, very likely to be sucked up in this sort of vortex, which then ended up destroying tens of millions of lives.
Mm. You know, something that we also kind of came across in going through some of the material for this piece, at least something that I was thinking about, was also just this problem of language and politics. And I mean, even just like at a very low level, just grammar. Because still to this day, there are a lot of sources that will describe some of the atrocities of the Second World War in like this very passive voice. You know, for instance, X number of people died in concentration camps, you know, X number of lives were lost. And that was definitely something that was just kind of on my mind in going through some of the material for this piece. You know, people were killed during the Second World War. People were killed during the Holocaust. And I guess it just kind of surprised me in going through some of this material how unchanged a lot of that language still is. And, you know, I mean, to maybe just kind of also briefly reflect on, again, like this matter of responsibility, agency, choices. You know, I mean, obviously it is an active choice to kill. You know, like lives don't just get lost somehow, like in nature or something. Like obviously these are all very intentional decisions made by specific people. And yeah, that was definitely just something that was kind of on my mind in the background here.
I think that's extremely relevant. And if we take the context of our times, once again, and we look, whether we're looking in Southeastern Europe or in the Middle East, we can see the conflicts that are raging there. And it is really hard for any reader of the news to fully understand what's going on. And that's why I think it's so valuable that people are being provided now with things like video. And there are attempts, I think, at trying to allow an average person to understand what these conflicts involve. And unfortunately, I think it's overwhelming to the average human consciousness to, you know, see starving children or, you know, people blown up and people being executed and just random sad fates for what should be ordinary people living ordinary lives. And I think whether we're talking about World War II or our modern context, we see the same lack of ability on our part to process just how tragic and violent these times are that these people lived in. Mm.
So maybe finally, I mean, obviously this is kind of a heavy topic, but it's also one which, you know, requires a lot of historical research. You know, I'm always just kind of curious as to whether there was anything really new that you learned, whether there is just anything that like really stood out to you as remarkable or interesting.
There were a number of things I'd like to mention. One of them was, as we've been talking about here, I was really surprised at people like Gudmundur Kampan, who again was assassinated there the day following the liberation of Denmark on suspicion of being an active collaborator with the Nazis. His reaction when he was being arrested was, "I have done nothing wrong. I am a good, honorable person. Leave me alone. You are brutes." And if you look at the way Björnsson's reaction was, he was very reluctant to remove his Nazi uniform, and he apparently handed over his pistol and grenade to the Icelandic embassy staff in Copenhagen and said, "Could you destroy this? Could you take care of this for me?" And apparently the staff themselves felt that this was an imposition because they did not feel they wanted to have anything to do with these horrible things. And it just shows you the dichotomy between those who took part, who felt that they hadn't really done anything that wrong, and people on the other side who are absolutely adamant that they are war criminals. We see this again with Oliver Peterson when he comes home from Norway and defends himself and says, "Look, I'm a totally nice, innocent guy. I have kids. I've got a business." And if you read his obituary in the right-leaning paper Morgenbladet at the time, it makes no mention of any of his court cases or his collaboration and so forth. And I think that this is maybe an understandable reaction. When things are that extreme, we simply can't handle it. So we just push it to the side and ignore it the best we can. And I believe that's what the survivors often do. And one has to ask oneself if that is in fact the best solution to bringing out some kind of peace and unity in the aftermath of a horrible conflict like World War II or what we're seeing today.
Well, I think we'll leave it there for today. But thank you for coming in to talk today, Frank.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Deep North is the official podcast of Iceland Review, the oldest continuously running English language publication on Iceland, covering community, nature, and culture. If you enjoyed listening, please consider subscribing to Iceland Review at our website.